Good evening and welcome to the KRFP Evening Report for Tuesday, February 25th, 2025. I'm Lee Robartis in the news tonight. Washington legislature may be able to pass a bill this year limiting rent increases for most tenants to 7% per year. Idaho House passes bill designed to limit youth access to what they call indecent performances in a bill that Representative Ted Hill of Eagle says targets drag. Reporters' source protection bill passes in Idaho House, and as the Trump administration and the Heritage Foundation move to further gaslight the U.S. by executive orders on patriotic education and how to celebrate the nation's 250th anniversary, historians at the University of Idaho are trying to get more accurate representation of the history for our nation's 250th. We'll have details on those stories and more coming up on the KRFP Evening Report. And live in the KRFP studios in Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lee Robartis, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. Some historians are pushing back on a Trump executive order on what he calls patriotic education, which says it will end indoctrination in K through 12 education. To the Trump administration, realistic and fair representations of U.S. history, especially when it concerns the nation's fraught history with racism and slavery, is indoctrination. Some of the concepts in the January executive order have spilled over to another executive order on how the nation should celebrate its upcoming 250th anniversary. The United States is preparing for the nation's 250th anniversary in 2026, the first major anniversary since the bicentennial, but the state of Idaho, in its official declaration, did not mention the University of Idaho. During a Renfrew interdisciplinary colloquium presentation at the UI library today, UI history professor and special collections director for the UI library, Dulcie Kirsting Lark, said she is involved in a campus-wide effort to program the upcoming celebration.
Every state has a subcommittee that is part of this planning process. Within the state of Idaho, it is led by the Idaho State Historical Society. You can see this is the composition of who is on there, and it's basically state agencies. And then this is the concurrent resolution that founded that. America 250 in Idaho provides an opportunity for Idahoans to participate in commemorating the ideals of the American Revolution, equality, liberty, and justice. America 250 in Idaho advances Idahoans' knowledge of our great state, fostering a shared sense of pride, belonging, and ownership in the state, in the state's future. But what was not part of that list that I just had up for you was the University of Idaho. There was not a space made for the University of Idaho to be part of the state's official recognition of America 250. And so when we understood that that would be the plan, there were a few folks on campus, Dr. Rebecca Schofield and myself and a few others, who really thought we need to make sure that this that America 250 has a presence on the University of Idaho campus. So we began meeting in August of last year and had some initial conversations. You can see our committee was made up of folks from across campus, and we really appreciated their insights. And then at the as the new year started, President Green also really wanted to be part of this conversation, and communications and marketing understood that there would be a role for the University of Idaho to play in how Idahoans across the state are acknowledging America 250. Ultimately, what we want to keep in mind is how has or does the University of Idaho contribute to the development of the state and the nation? That is sort of a unique position that we can take from here.
That was the head of special collections at the University of Idaho Library, Dulcie Kirsting Lark. The new Trump administration is making efforts to attack history education in the U.S. and has created by Executive Order Task 2026, which has rules about what part of history Americans should hear during the 250th anniversary celebration. Similarly, Trump's executive order on K-12 schooling in America claims, quote, imprinting anti-American, subversive, harmful, and false ideologies on our nation's children not only violates longstanding anti-discrimination civil rights law in many cases, but usurps basic parental authority. However, Trump is interpreting accurate tellings of the nation's history as anti-American and subversive. Kirsten Lark spoke about the executive orders and efforts by historians to counter it with a more accurate version of American history.
The American story is right now. We live in sort of, we say unprecedented times, though I would argue we just saw. It's not that unprecedented. We've frequently dealt with division. We have often been woefully behind in actually incorporating all the people that we say our founding documents were meant to incorporate. So why should we engage at all? Well, one, we want to make sure that we make space for student voices and facilitate student reflection on this anniversary, and importantly, support their right to free speech. There will be no shortage of lectures here or across the country about the American Revolution. I am sure of that. But there are a lot of opportunities for more engaging programming that is led by our next generation of leaders. We anticipate there will be levels of conversation, the national, state, and local levels, and we should be at the table to bring the expertise of our university and contribute to the nuanced dialogue that can happen. I have something else I'm going to say about that. I think another really big reason that was not clear to us in August of 24 when we were beginning, but now, there are efforts right now to establish, really renewed efforts, very strong efforts to establish an ahistorical, singular American story. The capital T American story. And for those of us who work in historical scholarship, who work in the American experience, we know that that is simply inaccurate. It's not even bad or good. It is inaccurate. So the America 250 anniversary is a component of the recent executive order ending radical indoctrination in K-12 schooling. If you haven't read that executive order, you might read it. But there are strong opinions expressed in that executive order about what America 250 should and should not do. And there are also scholarly organizations that are calling on professionals to contribute their expertise, particularly to public-facing efforts. It's not enough if we just write about it. It's not enough if we just talk about it in our academic circles. We need to be contributing outwardly. Specifically, the American Historical Association and the Organization of American Historians released a joint statement on this executive order. And it says, quote, the executive order grossly mischaracterizes history education across the United States, alleging educational malpractice as an institution that trains Idaho teachers. We know our teachers are trained to be exceptional professionals. They are not indoctrinating their students. The executive order's narrow conception of patriotism and patriotic education does more than deny the actual history of American democracy. It undermines its own goal of rigorous education and of merit-based society. If we do not teach a full story, we are not teaching quality history. We reject this premise. We reject the premise that it is anti-American or subversive to learn the full history of the United States. So that is a call to action. That is a call to action for scholars in the history profession, but really to anybody who has access to a nuanced understanding of the American experience. Of course, ultimately, we recognize that there's a need to balance professional ethics and the realities of the political moment, and we believe that centralizing student voices is a way to place positive focus and energy in a meaningful space. But I challenge all of us to think not just about what we find troubling about America's story. I think it's easy to be our own worst critics, but we need to think about what we treasure and are inspired by in the American story. What are we willing to stand up for as uniquely proud of as Americans? The historian Jill Lepore wrote, writing national history creates plenty of problems. There's no doubt about it. But not writing national history creates more problems, and those problems are worse. In the absence of our presence, there is a vacuum. There's a really terrific article that I just want to point out to you. It's called America is Suffering an Identity Crisis. It appeared in The Atlantic last fall. And just this one quote I want to read to you. To varying degrees, abolitionists, suffragists, labor leaders, and civil rights activists were willing and able to harness America's mythic rhetoric and stated principles to advance their causes. They embraced and invented cherished national symbols. And yet today, many who profess to believe in human equality and social justice seem to have little use of the American origin story and its most venerable words and figures. Why not reclaim them? The American Revolution was, after all, a revolution. Not in every respect the one you or I might have wanted, but an enormous stride toward equality. And revolution itself is an inherently malleable concept made to be renewed and redefined with each generation.
That was University of Idaho history professor and special collections director at the UI Library, Dulcie Kirsting Lark, speaking during a Renfrew Interdisciplinary Colloquium presentation at the UI Library today. Another speaker at the Renfrew Colloquium today spoke about a proposal from Moscow Historic Preservation Commission Chair Nils Reese to create a historic district on the University of Idaho campus. University of Idaho graduate student Nathan Moody said the district would be created under the National Historic Preservation Act.
The National Historic Preservation Act of 1966 was really a reaction to a decade and a half of demolition nationwide. Impelled by the modernist ethos that progress must equal new. And so the post-war development paradigm nationwide was one that was definitely one of demolition to make way for new construction. What the National Historic Preservation Act represents is a shift in our attitude where we began saying, you know, hold on a second, perhaps we ought to consider the cultural value embodied in our built heritage before we just capriciously demolish it.
That was University of Idaho graduate student Nathan Moody. Moody said a number of other prominent public and private universities around the nation have established historic preservation districts as a hedge against the easy destruction of older buildings that are examples of classic architectural styles.
To see this accomplished and have a listing done, there's two significant elements to this project that have to be done. The first is a survey, which is a physical examination of the district and all the resources it contains. By resources, I mean buildings, sites, objects, structures, the things within the district. They need to be physically evaluated and evaluated for their historic significance and also evaluated for their integrity, which is their ability to convey that significance, or in the context of a district, the ability to contribute to the district's historic significance. And so that's a fairly immense project, as you'll see. The second phase of getting a listing accomplished is the nomination, which is a report prepared for the National Park Service that details that gives a physical description of the district and the resources within, and then makes an argument for the district's historical significance and for the National Park Service to evaluate for eligibility to include on the National Register.
That was University of Idaho graduate student Nathan Moody speaking during the Renfrew Interdisciplinary Colloquium today at the University of Idaho Library. KRFP citizen journalist Brenda Cox assisted with this story. You're tuned in to the KRFP Evening Report on KRFP Moscow Pullman.
This program is made possible by KRFP members and the Palouse Peace Coalition. Palouse Peace Coalition is a consistent presence for peace since 2001. The Palouse Peace Coalition shares KRFP's progressive values and hosts a weekly peace vigil Fridays from 3 to 4 p.m. in Moscow's Friendship Square.
For information on becoming a KRFP underwriter, go to krfp.org and click Support KRFP.
Saturdays at 5:30 p.m.
But I like to shoot small game. Ducks, rabbits, squirrels, especially ducks.
Meet Ducks and Pipes.
That's where you got the name, Ducks.
How did you receive the name Pipes?
My business, installing background music.
Ducks and Pipes are two characters in the 11-part ZBS radio play Saratoga Springs, a radio play where the sounds come alive.
I'm replacing everything with small animals.
Saratoga Springs in all its stereophonic glory.
You're gonna have stuffed ducks.
Oh, yes, of course.
Ducks and Pipes live in a world where modern sound design is of the utmost importance.
Pipes, I want to create an environment for our banking clientele that reflects the feeling of the Adirondacks. The bubbling brooks, the wind in the pines, the dry leaves of autumn rustling in the birches.
The mist rising off the lake.
Chirping birds.
Honking of geese.
Katydid.
Call of the loon.
And music.
Yeah, with music.
Saratoga Springs, an 11-part radio adventure from ZBS, Saturday at 5:30 p.m. Another amazing cultural offering from the station that builds community.
The Idaho House yesterday passed a bill from Republican Representative Ed H. Ted Hill of Eagle that is designed to protect minors from viewing what he calls sexually indecent exhibitions. Representative Hill had said during earlier committee hearings in the House, his House Bill 230 is a reaction to drag performances in public areas in Coeur d'Alene and Boise recently. Here's Hill introducing debate on the House floor yesterday.
House Bill 230 creates a duty of care for any provider or performers of sexually indecent exhibitions to show reasonable care that minors can't observe these exhibitions. That's the focus of this bill. It's constitutionally sound. It's constitutionally regulated for time, place, and manner. It's permission of time, place, and manner. And what describes what is indecent? And first thing is it has to be sexual in nature, and that is in the bill and with the handout that I handed out. Second, it has to be patently offensive according to contemporary community standards. And that particular language is supported by the U.S. Supreme Court. So that language, everything is very specific about all the constitutional language. And third, if the FCC has standards for daytime TV, if it's outside the standards acceptable for that, it's outside the standards. It crosses the line of the indecent sexual exhibitions. So why are we doing this? The objective, I think, is clear. The impact it has on our children. Everyone sees this. There's increased sexual violence. They say more juvenile delinquency. But most importantly, you want to have kids have the opportunity to be ethically and morally develop regularly without these distractions. It's important for our children. And I see that the goalposts, as they say, are moving. What is acceptable? The reason why the government needs to step in because the boundary keeps moving farther and farther out, and that's where it's time for us to say, let's protect our children.
That was Republican Representative Ed H. Ted Hill of Eagle speaking on the House floor yesterday. Democratic Representative Elena Rubel of Boise was the only member of the House to debate the bill. She was against it.
I appreciate the desire to protect our children, but what this bill proposes is not even close to the indecency standards of daytime television or any indecency standards. This is an extremely vague standard that's being put forth that has never been construed by any court and is extremely subjective, and I think would frankly run afoul of the First Amendment and would probably result in shutting down a lot of the arts in Idaho that are not indecent. Particularly, I direct you to page 5, line 6, where it would prohibit, or at least open up to civil liability, sexually provocative dances or gestures performed with accessories that exaggerate male or female primary or secondary sexual characteristics. This is not a legal term of art. This is very much in the eye of the beholder. This could be a padded bra. It could be a belt. It could be leggings or tight leotards. And sexually provocative dances. No court anywhere that I'm aware of has ever construed this. This could be a shake of the hips. This could be leaning over. This could be any form of gyration that would be very normal in an ordinary jazz dance troupe. I feel like you would not be able to put on a high school production of Grease under this bill. ordinary theater would be exposed to vast amounts of civil liability. I think this goes way too far, and I know it's not criminal, but people are not going to put on a show if they open themselves up to being at risk of being sued for millions and millions of dollars. So I think this would hobble the arts in Idaho if it ever were to go into effect, although I feel it would probably not, because I think it would probably be struck down by a court before then. But regardless, I hope you will give this your red light and preserve the First Amendment and the ability of arts in Idaho to operate.
That was Democratic Representative Elena Rubel of Boise. The bill creates a personal cause for action, which allows parents of a child exposed to what are called indecent sexual performances to sue the people that put on the performances. The bill passed in the House on a 54-11 vote. All the Democrats in the House voted against the bill. The only Republicans to vote against the bill were Dustin Manwaring of Pocatello and Jack Nelson of Jerome. Five representatives were absent and did not vote. District 6 Representative Lori McCann of Lewiston voted in favor of the bill. The bill now heads to the Senate side. The Idaho House today unanimously passed a bill to protect journalist sources. The SHIELD law, which passed 69-0, says no person engaged in journalistic activities shall be compelled to disclose in any legal proceeding, trial, before any court, or before any jury, the source of any information procured or obtained and published in a newspaper, print publication, digital news outlet, or by a radio or television broadcasting station with which the person is engaged or employed, or with which the person is connected. Republican Representative Barbara Ehart of Idaho Falls introduced House Bill 158 on the House floor.
Idaho outlets have been facing an increasing growing number of subpoenas. And as we had Melissa Davlin, as she was in reporting, she's our Idaho Press, I forget her title, the current president of the Idaho Press Club. She has shared with us that over the last 8 months, the subpoenas have increased exponentially. And one of the problems that is happening is a lot of the subpoenas are going after the smaller reporters or the smaller newspapers because they know some of the larger ones can fight it. But when I say fight it, what does that even mean by can fight it? It means that you are forced to go through the process of financially hiring an attorney, putting your reporting on hold, trying to protect sources that gave information to you confidentially. And if you reveal that, obviously, you're not going to be, media will not be in a position to be able to gather that information anymore if they feel like you're going to reveal the information and who they were. Reporters regularly receive tips over email or off-the-record conversations. They have notes. These things would all be protected under this should we be able to move forward. Text messages, etc. And this part is important. The only thing right now protecting or stopping a journalist from revealing their sources is their own personal ethics. And this has forced journalists, it's not just the heavy fine they've had to pay in having to hire an attorney. Many have gone to jail. They've been sent to jail, and they've sat there at their own volition trying to protect the sources. And at some point, that's not right. At some point, we need to do what other states are doing to protect our sources.
That was Republican Representative Barbara Ehart of Idaho Falls. The bill now heads to the Senate side. U.S. District Court Judge Jamal Whitehead in Seattle today issued a nationwide injunction against the Trump administration's executive order suspending the U.S. refugee admissions program. Judge Whitehead wrote, "I cannot ignore Congress's detailed framework for refugee admissions and the limits it places on the president's ability to suspend the same. The evidence before me shows that plaintiffs face concrete irreparable harms, including refugees stranded after selling their possessions, agencies laying off hundreds of staff, and family reunification suspended indefinitely." Refugees are plaintiffs in the lawsuit. They include a family of three in Iraq, another family of three from the Democratic Republic of Congo, a mother trying to be reunited with her daughter, who's in South Africa, a mother and son from Iraq waiting for resettlement from Jordan, and a man from Afghanistan, among others.
Seven members of Oregon's congressional delegation have signed a letter demanding protection for the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau to enable the federal agency to continue its work. The Department of Government Efficiency closed the bureau earlier this month. Jagjit Nagra with Oregon Consumer Justice says the CFPB plays a key role in protecting Oregonians from deception and overcharges by banks and other financial institutions. He says this oversight is especially important to prevent predatory lending for large purchases like mortgages and student loans.
When you take away that enforcement mechanism, you're basically giving Wall Street the chance to say, oh, okay, now we can do more of whatever we want.
The CFPB was created in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis, and since then, Nagra adds, the agency has returned $21 billion to consumers. Nagra says without the Bureau, Oregonians will have less protection against hidden fees and financial scams, among other things. Critics of the CFPB say the Bureau has lacked accountability and its regulations stifle financial innovation. But Nagra says the Great Recession, along with other banking savings and lending scandals, show the nation needs oversight and strong enforcement of consumer financial protection laws.
The CFPB never gets in the way of those businesses doing the right thing. The CFPB goes after businesses and other organizations that are defrauding consumers, that are cheating consumers.
The letter, signed by Oregon Democrats, charges that big financial institutions, which the CFPB was created to regulate, have prioritized dismantling it. Nagra points out that consumer protection shouldn't be a partisan issue because everyone is a consumer. He emphasizes the need for a united consumer voice. I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
Republican Representative Jeff Ehlers of Meridian has introduced a bill that would place a deal-killing $25,000 per foot excise tax on wind turbines if the majority of county voters disapprove of a new wind farm. The bill seems aimed at the planned Lava Ridge wind project outside of Twin Falls, which would place 231 turbines with a maximum height of 660 feet on acreage there. If each of the wind turbines were to be 600 feet high, the excise tax on all the wind turbines would be $3.5 billion. If the turbines were 100 feet high, the excise tax for the project would be about $578 million. Ehler said the excise tax would apply even if the wind farm is built on federal public lands. At the introductory hearing on the bill yesterday, Democratic Representative Steve Birch of Boise said, "I must say that I'm concerned about the notion of taxing the free market out of the ability to do things that are legal, and I'm concerned about the precedents that this might set on other areas as well." The bill will come before the House Revenue and Taxation Committee for a full public hearing soon. After Judge Stephen Hippler in Boise rejected a defense request to throw out DNA and other evidence in the Koberger quadruple murder trial, lead defense attorney Ann Taylor is switching out one of the three members of the defense team. Northern Idaho State Public Defender Jay Logsdon, who has been the number two defender in Koberger's death penalty case for the last 2 years, will be replaced by former San Francisco Public Defender's Office employee Bick Barlow. Lead defense attorney Ann Taylor wrote to Judge Hippler asking Barlow be added to the legal team. According to the Idaho Statesman, Taylor wrote that Logsdon will not participate at trial counsel. Since 2013, Barlow has run a private law office that focuses on cases with forensic DNA evidence. Barlow has already participated in the case as a defense witness. In August 2023, she testified at a hearing in which the prosecution was trying to limit disclosure of some aspects of the FBI's use of investigative genetic genealogy in the case. The prosecution objected to Barlow's testimony. The prosecution objected to Barlow's testimony, saying it was a veiled attempt to include the legal conclusions of an attorney not affiliated with the case. The previous judge in the case, John Judge of Moscow, allowed the defense to call Barlow to the stand and later awarded DNA records to the defense. Logsdon is an employee of the Idaho State Public Defender's Office. The Idaho Statesman reports State Public Defender's Office spokesperson Patrick Orr declined to comment on the removal of Logsdon from the case. The 30-year-old Brian Koberger is accused of stabbing to death four University of Idaho students in bedrooms of an off-campus house on November 13, 2022. The deceased are 21-year-old Madison Mogan of Coeur d'Alene, 21-year-old Kaylee Gonsalves of Rathdrum, 20-year-old Zena Kernodal of Post Falls, and 20-year-old Ethan Chapin of Mount Vernon, Washington. Democrats in the Washington legislature may have the support they need to pass a bill that would prohibit landlords statewide from raising rents or fees by more than 7% during a 12-month period. The Senate Housing Committee passed the bill last week, which has an exemption for buildings nonprofits own and for housing that was built in the last 10 years. Senate Bill 5222 also requires landlords to give 180 days notice to tenants before increasing rents by more than 3%. It would also limit some move-in and deposit fees. According to the Washington State Standard, the same bill failed in the Senate Housing Committee last year by one vote when a Democrat on the committee declined to vote yes or no on the measure, but the committee has more progressive Democrats now. Supporters say the bill is necessary to help people avoid homelessness, while opponents say it will disincentivize those who want to build new developments. Democratic Senator Emily Alvarado of Seattle said this bill simply provides some common sense safeguards that say landlords cannot raise the rent to an excessive level. The next stop for the bill on the Senate side is the Senate Ways and Means Committee. The bill has cleared two committees on the House side and is set for a vote on the House floor. Well, that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Taking a look at the weather, there's a 20% chance of rain and snow before 7 p.m. Snow level 3,400 feet, lowering to 2,600 feet after midnight. Mostly cloudy, gradually becoming mostly clear. Low 29. Breezy, west winds 15 to 20, becoming light and variable. Winds could gust up to 30 miles per hour. Sunny tomorrow, high 45. Partly cloudy Wednesday night, low 31. Mostly sunny Thursday, high 51. Partly cloudy Thursday night, low 31, and mostly sunny, high 52 on Friday. Currently 43 degrees. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscast you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on KRFP, be sure to become a member of KRFP. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. Or you can go to the KRFP website to find out more ways to help KRFP. There's a drop-down box that says Support KRFP. You can underwrite programming, which is a cost-effective way of letting our listeners know that your business or nonprofit supports KRFP and community radio. There's also a PayPal option, and you can adopt a DJ. There's a Patreon button as well. Once again, we'll gladly accept checks of any amount at KRFP 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. I'm Lee Robartis. Brenda Cox assisted with tonight's newscast. Have a pleasant evening. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman. Community radio for the Palouse. Flashpoints is up next. That'll be followed by Under Construction, a show about community building, and that'll go from 7:30 to 9:30. Music begins in earnest with the Brent Bent Show, 9:30 to 11 o'clock tonight. At 11 o'clock, we'll have an additional episode of the podcast Sons of Patriarchy, which we're running on the radio station. That will go till midnight or 12:30, and then music, entertainment, information throughout your evening and throughout the night here at KRFP Moscow Pullman.